Let's get straight to the point. You want to grow your portfolio to deal with the rising cost of inflation, to pay off your debt or your mortgage, pretty much anything standing in the way of you and financial freedom, right? Well, with Yahoo Finance, you can get access to the news, data, and tools that you need in order to help you reach that financial freedom. And when it comes to your financial future, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, you've invested all that you can. And now you need to take those investments to the next level by using what every financial great uses. Yahoo Finance. For more than 25 years, Yahoo Finance has been the brand behind every great investor. They're the number one finance destination, producing a holistic look at the financial news cycle, including breaking news, original perspectives, analyst ratings, independent research, customizable charts, and so much more. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor, yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination. That's yahoofinance.com.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
The Peter Schiff Show.
This afternoon, we got the minutes from the last Federal Open Market Committee meeting, which took place a few weeks ago. And this was the meeting where the Federal Reserve did what is now being described as probably the biggest policy shift in the history of the Fed. I mean, really an abrupt about face, where they went from everything is great, we're going to keep on raising interest rates, and we are on autopilot, we're just going to let the balance sheet continue to decline. And all of a sudden now, they're patient, meaning they're not going to raise rates at all in the foreseeable future. And not only is the balance sheet reduction program no longer on autopilot, but it is now going to end prematurely sometime this year. Of course, the balance sheet is still north of $4 trillion. And if the reduction program comes to an end this year, you're still going to be talking about a balance sheet $3.5 to $4 trillion in size, which would mean that almost all of the mortgages and treasuries, which the Federal Reserve purchased in the aftermath of the 2008 financial crisis, that it purchased as part of its quantitative easing programs 1, 2, and 3, almost all of that debt will remain on its balance sheet after the Fed has finished shrinking it. Also, Federal Open Market Committee officials are now talking about quantitative easing once again as just another tool in the Fed's toolbox, that it's no longer something that's just going to be pulled out when there's an emergency. It's just going to be a normal policy tool for the Fed to deal with recessions. And of course, that's going to be their main tool, given that this next recession is going to start when interest rates are at 2.25%. And so there's not a lot of room for the Fed to try to artificially stimulate the economy when it hardly has any room to reduce rates because they're already so low. So the Fed is going to have to do more quantitative easing. Now, of course, what does that mean about the Fed's balance sheet? That means that it's ultimately going to be much higher than it was when the Fed began its current operation quantitative tightening. We're going to be higher than we were before it started. And again, all this does is confirm what I've known all along, what I've been saying all along, that quantitative easing is debt monetization. It is a permanent source of liquidity for the government, where the central bank just creates money out of thin air and uses that money to buy government debt. That is exactly what Ben Bernanke assured Congress they were not doing. When he was first asked in 2009 or 2010, I forget the exact date, by Congress, when he was testifying, when Congress was saying, hey, you're monetizing the debt. This is a bad to do. This is banana republic. Ben Bernanke said, we are not monetizing the debt. He said the difference between nations that monetize the debt and what the Federal Reserve was doing is that when nations are monetizing debt, it's a permanent source of financing. Ben Bernanke assured Congress that all of the bonds that the government was buying were just going to be on the balance sheet temporarily, that when the emergency was over, the Fed was going to sell whatever bonds it bought during the emergency. Now, at the time, I said that wasn't true. Now, whether Ben Bernanke knew it wasn't true and was lying, or if he was just mistaken, nobody but Ben Bernanke knows. But at the time, I said that's not true. I said there is no way the Fed is going to be able to sell off these securities, that this is, in fact, debt monetization. Well, now we know for a fact, even though it's 10 years later, we now have an official admission by the Federal Reserve that they did monetize the debt. Now, the question is, had Ben Bernanke been forthright with Congress back then, would they allow the Fed to do these programs? If the Fed had said, yes, this is monetization, we're buying these bonds and we're never going to sell them, but they were pretending all along that it was temporary, and I was saying from the beginning that it was permanent. That's why I kept saying that we're going to have more QEs and Markey movies. That's why I said we're in a monetary roach motel, except at the time, nobody believed me. Well, it turns out that I was right, because now the Fed has made it official. They are never going to shrink their balance sheet back to where it was before the crisis. That means the entire increase, based on wherever they stopped shrinking it, that entire increase was monetized. And of course, when we have the next recession, they're going to have to buy back whatever they just sold and then some, and the balance sheet's going to run up to new highs. You know, and also this about face that the Fed just did, everybody is acting as if this was a surprise, that, oh, you know, it was all based on some new information, that the Fed was going to continue to raise rates. They were going to shrink their balance sheet, but then something happened and they couldn't do it. They are missing the point that whatever that something was that happened was bound to happen from the start. I always said it was only a question of what the excuse would be for the Fed to abort the balance sheet shrinking and the normalization of interest rates. This was not a surprise to me. The only thing that surprised me is that it took so long to get to the point where the Fed had to call it off. The markets were so dumb that the Fed was able to continue this charade all the way until now, until the fourth quarter of 2018. And then they finally had to admit that they weren't going to keep raising rates and that they weren't going to be able to unwind their balance sheet, because the markets finally were scared. And they should have been scared a lot sooner. But, you know, everybody was too drunk on tax cuts and make America great again and this false belief that everything was fine. And then all of a sudden they got a shock of reality. And now the Fed has come back with another lifeline and temporarily caused the market to bounce. And this is where we are now. And in fact, the market is not rising as much. We got, again, yesterday you had Donald Trump came out and said that the deadline for the sanctions or the new tariffs to be imposed on China is not a magical date. Basically saying that, well, we have this date, but, you know, if we don't make the date, you know, maybe we're not going to have the tariffs. And, you know, the market rallied a little bit on that, but it couldn't really sustain much of the rally. So the fact that we can't get more mileage out of the same regurgitated bullish news could be an indication, again, that the market is running out of steam. The Dow managed to add on about 63 points today, even though there was, I think, a headline that came by about tariffs potentially on European cars. In fact, that's actually caused the gold market to sell off a little bit. It ended up down a couple of bucks on the day, not really reacting much to the Fed minutes, because I think gold actually reacted yesterday, because yesterday you had another headline story. You had Cleveland Fed President Mester came out and basically said that she supported, a end to the balance sheet reduction this year. And gold was up $18 an ounce yesterday, based on that. So, I didn't really have a lot left to rally on the minutes when we pretty much got that rally yesterday. In fact, gold closed down about $2 today, down at 1338-ish. We were up maybe around 1345 earlier in the morning before the minutes came out. But again, the big move was yesterday. But I don't think the move is over. I think we're up against some resistance, and I have a pretty good feeling that this time we're going to cut through that resistance. Especially I was listening on CNBC and Scott Nations, who has always been my nemesis back when they used to have me on. In fact, the last time I was on CNBC was almost 2 years ago, and Scott Nations was there with me. And basically, Scott Nations was yelling at me for recommending gold. He was questioning my objectivity. He said that I was scaremongering and, people shouldn't be buying gold, and I was dishonest and I was simply trying to sell gold. And look, yes, Shift Gold sells gold, but really what we do at Shift Gold is we help people buy gold, because I don't sell my own gold. I'm buying gold, and I'm trying to advocate other people buy gold too. And so I help them do that through Shift Gold. I mean, I'm a middleman. I buy gold wholesale and turn around and sell it retail. So I'm not really selling any gold. I am helping people to accumulate gold. And that is, what I'm trying to do. And of course, I'm not just telling people to buy gold. I mean, gold is part of what I do. I made this point to Scott Nations. I also tell people that they should be investing in stocks, they should be investing in bonds, that they should have balanced, diversified portfolios. But what I am advocating is that people stay away from the U.S. market and the U.S. dollar, because I believe a major crisis, a dollar crisis and a sovereign debt crisis, is coming. And, he was just, telling me I was a fool for buying gold. Of course, the price is higher now. But I turned the tables. I remember in that interview, I basically said, wait a minute, you're accusing me of being a shill. What about CNBC? What about all the people that come on constantly and just tout U.S. stocks? They're never bearish. They're always bullish. Everything is great, right? Why don't you accuse them of talking their books? Why don't you accuse them of being dishonest? And that was the last time I was on CNBC. It was almost 2 years ago. It'll be 2 years in April. And that was the very last appearance that I was on. Maybe it had something to do with my calling out CNBC on the mindless cheerleader that goes on there for the U.S. economy, the U.S. stock market, because that's what they were accusing me of when it comes to gold. But when I turned the tables on them, I guess the way they responded was by not having me on again. But the reason I bring this up is because Scott Nations was on CNBC today and yesterday telling people to short gold. That was his great idea of a great trade, was that, hey, go out and short gold, right? And I think he has a stop maybe about $30 higher. And my feeling is that anybody following his advice is going to be stopped out. And, one of the rationales that Nations used for why this is a great time to short gold, he said that the dollar is near the highs. And so we've had a strong dollar, and a strong dollar is a headwind for gold, and therefore you should sell gold. Now, while he is correct that a strong dollar is a headwind for gold, what he is overlooking is that gold is rising despite that headwind, which means it's really strong, right? If gold can go up even with a headwind, that's a good sign. What Nations should be thinking about is, wait a minute, if gold is this strong with a headwind, what's going to happen when it's got a tailwind? What's going to happen when the dollar gets weak? Because if the dollar is still near the highs, it's more likely to go down. And when the dollar starts to go down, that's when the gold rally is really going to pick up. And all the people who are following Scott's Nation's advice to short gold, that's when they're all going to get stopped out. Now, at least he has the sense to put in a stop, because that will limit his losses. But the losses are going to be there. And the fact that the only real talk about gold going on now on CNBC is that you should short it, to me, this is just more of a reason to believe that this rally has legs and that we're going quite a bit higher. Now, also, there's been a lot of other bad economic news that came out last week. I forgot to mention this on the podcast that I did on Friday, but we got the results on student loan delinquencies, all-time record high. I mean, of course, we have a record high amount of student debt, but we also now have a record in the delinquencies on that debt. And of course, this is coming when the economy is supposedly good, when jobs are supposedly plentiful. So if we have these record high delinquencies now, when times are supposedly good, imagine what's going to happen to student loan delinquencies during the next recession. The same thing goes with auto loans. Last week, we heard that the delinquency rate on auto loans, not just the amount of loans that are delinquent, because that's probably an all-time record, but the percentage of loans that are delinquent, and they define delinquent as missing three car payments in a row. So the percentage of people who have a car loan who have not made a payment in more than 3 months is at a 10-year high. So you have to go back to the Great Recession, 2009, to find auto loan delinquency rates comparable to what we have today. Now, how can that be? Because back then, unemployment was 10%. Now it's only 4%. Yet we have all these delinquencies. I mean, people make their car payments, right? The only reason you're not going to make one is because you can't afford it. Because after all, if you don't make your car payments, they repossess your car. And, you know, most people need their cars. They want their cars. So they're gonna stop making their credit card payments before they stop making their auto loan payments, because the credit cards, they got no collateral. They can't take anything. You stop, paying on your credit cards, there's nothing they can do, right? And there are people, sometimes they'll take out loans against their houses, you know, so they can keep their car, they can make their car payments. So to the extent that you've got this high a delinquency rate in auto loans, really shows you that people just have no way of making these payments. And this is when unemployment is 4%. What's going to happen to the delinquency rates when it goes back up to 10%? Right? I mean, just imagine that. But this, again, anecdotal evidence that something is wrong, right? The economy can't be booming if so many people aren't making their car payments. I mean, are people going to try to pretend that, hey, all these employed people who own cars and have loans, they're so excited, they're so happy about this booming economy that they just forgot to mail in their car payments for 3 months in a row? I mean, I don't think that's the reason. People don't have the money, right? Even though they may have a job, it doesn't pay enough to make their car payment. And again, this is also part of the car bubble, the subprime lending bubble in autos, just like the subprime lending that we had in homes. People bought cars they couldn't afford, and the fact that delinquencies are soaring is more proof that that took place. And of course, what about the lenders, the people who provided this credit? Well, there's going to be a lot of losses when these loans ultimately go into default and the cars are repossessed and they can't sell them for enough to retire the debt. Also, in the last retail sales report, I noticed that this was the fourth month out of five that sales at restaurants had declined. And that is a big drop in restaurant sales. We haven't had restaurant sales this week in 25 years. So the question is, why are fewer people eating out at restaurants? Well, it's expensive to eat at restaurants, so people are eating at home. And in fact, that helps explain the beat in Walmart earnings. People got excited yesterday. Walmart came out with better than expected earnings. But if you actually look at the numbers, a lot of that had to do with higher prices that consumers were paying. So that's inflation, because remember, it's just the sales numbers are a reflection of prices too, not just volume. But if you look at where the volume was, a lot of it was in groceries, right? There was a big increase in groceries that Walmart is selling. And obviously groceries at higher prices because they're raising their prices. But if more people are buying groceries at Walmart, what does that mean? Well, maybe fewer people are eating in restaurants. So because they're not eating in restaurants, they need more groceries, right, to buy food to cook it themselves. But also my feeling would be that Walmart probably is a low-cost provider of grocery items. And so to the extent that people are buying more groceries at Walmart rather than their local grocery store or supermarket, probably means that they're just trying to do their best to squeeze every dollar out of their food budget. I mean, maybe they have to drive a little further to get to a Walmart, but they need to do it to save money because the prices there are cheaper than they would get at a closer market. So while this is good for Walmart, it may be bad for other supermarkets that are selling less groceries because more people are looking for bargains at Walmart. And the same thing, too, their online sales. Their online sales picked up, and that maybe is at the expense of brick-and-mortar shopping that might have taken place someplace else and is now taking place online at Walmart. So even though those earnings were good, I think when you look beneath the surface, you still see the anecdotal evidence of problems in the economy. And in fact, you know, I read this article, I forget the newspaper it was in. It had to do with the increasing minimum wage. And the article was about how, hey, these workers, they finally won this $15 an hour minimum wage. This is great, but now they have to deal with a problem of unfair firing. You know, unfair firings, because obviously it's not fair that people who are getting fired now. And so instead of getting the higher minimum wage, they're getting zero because they're getting fired. And people are saying this is unfair that these low wage workers are losing their jobs. There's nothing unfair about it. What's unfair is the minimum wage. I mean, it's unfair to workers and it's unfair to employers. But what the liberals are going to be finding out is you can set whatever minimum wage you want, right? And I think it's illegal when the federal government does it because it's exploit the Commerce Clause, right? So I think all that stuff is illegal, the federal minimum wage. But there's nothing that says that a state can't, you know, set a minimum wage if it's dumb enough to do it, right? So if states are imposing these minimum wages, they can set it wherever they want. But what they can't do is force anybody to actually pay it. Basically, the choice is either you don't hire anybody or you hire somebody and pay them $15 an hour. And for many employers, the answer is I hire nobody. Those are my choices. Pay somebody who's only worth $5 an hour, $15 an hour, or don't hire them at all. And with that choice, a lot of employers, well, I'm not going to hire them at all. I mean, I would hire them and pay them the $5 an hour that they're worth, but if my choice is 15 or zero, well, then I'm going to take zero. And there's nothing unfair about that. I mean, if an employer fires a worker because that worker is now too expensive to employ, what would be unfair would be to force the employer to keep hiring somebody, because people don't hire people just out of the goodness of their hearts. I mean, people hire people because they're trying to make a profit and they're hiring people to help them make a profit. But if you hire somebody and all they can add is $5 of value to your business, but if it costs you $15 an hour to bring them on, you're losing $10 an hour. Nobody is hiring people to lose money. And so if you force people to lose money, then they will eliminate those employees. And whether they're going to automate or they're going to outsource or they're just going to do the work themselves or, you know, try to find a way to have other people pick up the slack and maybe raise their wages a little bit instead of, you know, raising the unskilled wages a lot. This is what is going on. And, you know, Illinois, I just read today, they just approved a big hike in their minimum wage. They're going to increase their minimum wage to $15 an hour by 2025. I mean, don't they have enough problems in the state of Illinois? I mean, can't they look around at some of the problems that other states are already having that have increased the minimum wage? But the real problem, right, the big layoffs are going to come in this next recession. That's when a lot of the problems of the minimum wage hikes are going to really show up. But of course, a lot of liberals are not going to make the connection because, you know, there's going to be several years of a lag between these big minimum wage increases and this recession. But a lot of the jobs that are going to be destroyed are going to be destroyed not really because of the recession, but because of the minimum wage law. Maybe during a recession without the increase in the minimum wage, some of these jobs or more of these jobs would have been able to be retained. Employers may have been able to afford to keep more of these workers on. But when you combine a recession with a big increase in minimum wage, I think the number of unemployed is going to skyrocket. So as bad as the jump in unemployment was in the last recession, the jump in unemployment in this next recession is going to be much worse. And again, remember, everybody who thinks a recession is eventually going to come, they all believe that it's going to be mild. And I keep saying, why would you think this next recession is going to be mild? Right. One of the things that's going to be make it so much worse is that there's going to be a lot more layoffs. But, you know, another big problem that we're going to have in this next recession, I was watching an interview with Jeff Gundlach on Yahoo Finance, and Jeff made an excellent point about corporate debt and the fact that so much of the existing corporate debt has such a low investment rating. right? That the rating agencies have low investment grade ratings on, you know, a lot of the current corporate debt. And while a lot of the bulls on Wall Street have been talking about how great the stock market is and how corporate balance sheets are in great shape, they don't look at the actual amount of debt that they have and, you know, the rating on that debt, because a lot of the cash, for example, that is on corporate balance sheets has been borrowed. A lot of the earnings growth has been the result of share buybacks. Share buybacks have been financed with debt. And so companies, corporations have a lot of debt, and the ratings on that debt are low. But what's going to happen during the next recession is exactly what happens during every recession. Corporations are going to see increases or decreases, rather, in their earnings, right, due to the recession. And that is going to cause the ratings on a lot of their bonds to go down. Well, the problem is, since so many corporations are barely on the cusp of investment grade right now, during the next recession, you're going to have a record percentage of, you know, publicly traded companies having their debt downgraded to junk, which is a major problem. And that is going to severely exacerbate the downturn in the stock market and the economy during the next recession. And very few people are looking at this or pointing this out, but this corporate debt time bomb is there. And again, it's not just corporate debt that's going to be a problem in the next recession. It's government debt. It's individual debt, the student loans, the auto loans, the credit card debt. And also the point that Gundlach made, which is a correct point, is that his fear is that during the next recession, instead of the typical relief that we get where in a recession, long-term interest rates fall, he says he's worried that during the next recession, long-term interest rates won't fall. And he's right. They're not going to fall. They're actually going to rise. That's what's going to compound the misery, that and rising consumer prices, because he pointed out the reason that deficits will, long-term interest rates are not going to fall is because of the exploding deficit, because the debt is already so big. And he makes the point that I've been making, that the real deficit is not what they admit officially, but what they actually borrow when you include all the off-budget items. But we're already in excess of $1.2 trillion a year in deficit spending during the boom, that during the next bust, we're going to be $2 to $3 trillion. The markets can't absorb all of that selling. The inflationary implications of that should scare the bejesus out of the bond market. So long-term interest rates should not only not go down, they should go up. So this is going to be the mother of all recessions. You know, the last recession, they say, was the worst one since the Great Depression. The next one could be the worst one, including the Great Depression. You know, by the way, one other fact about the Gundlach interview on Yahoo Finance, it was 4 days, I think, after the podcast that I did on the Green New Deal. And basically, Gundlach took pretty much verbatim again one of the points I made from that podcast, which again shows that he probably listens to all of my podcasts, and I'm very happy that he listens. The point that he made that I think he got from me was when he was talking about the Green New Deal and how much it's going to cost and the fact that they all believe it's going to be paid for by the rich, he went back and cited the very statistics that I used to say that the World War II was financed by big tax increases on the middle class and the working poor. He went back and said, hey, in 1929, the lowest tax rate was 1.5%, and by 1944, it was at 25%, which is exactly the statistics, the years, and the figures that I used on my podcast to make that point that the bartender has no clue when she says that we're going to pay for the Green New Deal the same way we paid for World War II or the old New Deal under FDR. She has no idea that that stuff was paid for by increasing taxes dramatically, dramatically. You know, again, even after the reduction in 1946, where the bottom rate went down from 25 to 20, that was still a 1,200% increase from the 1.5% it was at in 1929. I mean, it was only about a 40-50% increase on the top bracket. Even though it went up to 91, it started at 25. But when you're talking about 1.5 to 20, the percentage increase is much bigger. Now, of course, it doesn't bother me that the Gundlach, uses my material to help support his view, which is very similar in some cases to mine. Just, you know, my view is, I think, a lot more bearish than his. Although privately, I think he's probably more bearish than he lets on publicly. I just don't pull any of my punches when I talk about this stuff. So it doesn't bother me. The only thing that I would like to see, just once in a while, I would like to see Gundlach throw it in the faces of the people who are interviewing him and give me credit for one of these things, you know, for one of the quotes or one of the analogies, because I'd like some of these guys to know that he listens to me, because, you know, he's like the e-ticket. He is the holy grail interview. Everybody in financial media, right? That this is like, you know, bagging the elephant. They all want him to be on. He's the Bond King. Everybody wants that interview, and they'll bend over backwards to get him on. Yet the same networks won't have me on at all, right? I've been banned. And the reason that I'm banned is because they think that what I have to say is just not worth listening to, that I'm so crazy, that I'm so out there, that they actually want to make sure their audience doesn't hear what I have to say, because who knows, maybe they'll actually act on something I'm saying. Maybe they'll actually follow my advice and buy some gold, or maybe they'll sell U.S. stocks and buy some foreign stocks. And we want to make sure they don't do that. So let's keep Peter Schiff off the air. But then again, they have Jeff Gundlach on and he listens to me. So I'm good enough for Gundlach, but I'm not good enough for, you know, the average investor who supposedly watches CNBC. Again, I said before that maybe it's kind of like, you know, porn. You know, people watch porn, like most guys. I mean, watch some porn, but no one wants to admit that they watch porn. So there are a lot of people, probably not just Jeff Gundlach. There are probably other people, on Wall Street that maybe we've heard of who actually do listen to me, but they don't want to admit it. So maybe if a big guy like Gundlach admitted that he listened to Peter Schiff, then maybe other people might come out of the closet and admit it too. You know, I mean, it's like nobody wants to admit that they watch porn. Or, you know, I remember when Playboy first came out. I mean, why do you think they put all those articles in the Playboy magazine, right? Because, you know, when Playboy came out in the 1950s, right, there's a bunch of naked pictures of women. That's what the guys wanted to see. But they put all these articles in there in between the women so people could say, yeah, you know, I buy it for the articles. I mean, yeah, I noticed the pictures, but I'm really buying it for the articles, right? See, that created the plausible deniability, right? You could pretend that you were interested in the articles when you really couldn't give a damn about the articles. You were buying the magazine because you want to look at the naked women. So, you know, I think that if somebody like of Gundlach stature admits that he listens to Peter Schiff, well, maybe other people could admit that they listen to me too. And I think I'd like to see it thrown in the faces of some of these producers and some of these people to let them know that, you know, that there's value in what I'm saying, even if they don't want to recognize it, that other people do. Hey, there was one bit of good news, though, that I read out of the Supreme Court today. They, an unanimous decision to strike down a law, state laws, where the police department could basically, through forfeiture, they could just confiscate assets for, you know, small offenses. Like if they find a joint in your car, right, they seize the entire car. You know, which is completely a violation of the Constitution. It's excessive fines, which are not allowed by the Constitution. You know, I remember the worst story I read was about a guy that owned a motel. And apparently there was a drug dealer who had used one of the motel rooms to conduct a drug transaction. The owner had no idea that this was going on, and the police busted them. But then they seized the entire hotel because that's where the transaction was taking place. You're talking about millions of dollars lost to the owner who did nothing wrong, had no idea that the person who rented out the room was dealing drugs, and they're just able to seize these assets. I mean, they do the same thing with cash forfeitures, right? If you're traveling, you've got cash, they just assume, oh, that cash is going to be used in a drug crime, and they just seize it. They don't have to have any proof. So it's not just about excessive fines. What about the due process? You know, what about they seize your cash just because they assume that you acquired your cash by dealing drugs when they have no proof that you did that? You know, and I hope this is just the first step in more Supreme Court decisions. We got to go after the IRS. The government routinely seizes property in violation of due process. They're almost everything they do violates due process in the way they seize assets or, you know, garnish bank accounts. All this stuff is a violation of the Constitution. So I'm glad that we're finally getting some good rulings coming out of the Supreme Court, which does encourage me that in 2021, when we get the socialists involved and they start passing a lot of this Green New Deal nonsense, that we'll actually have a Supreme Court with some justices that have the integrity to strike this stuff down as unconstitutional, because all of it is going to be unconstitutional. But I want to finish up the podcast with a couple of topics. One is an update on the Jesse Smollett case. As I suspected on my last podcast, the two Nigerian brothers who were arrested for the alleged hate crime were let go because they ratted out Jesse. You know, obviously they didn't want to go down for a fake crime, so they sang like canaries and they told the police exactly what happened, which was that Jesse hired them to fake this hate crime. They were paid, I think, $3,500 up front. There was another $500 on the back end to do it. In fact, you know, the brothers purchased the rope and they even rehearsed the fake crime. They had a dress rehearsal. I don't know if it was a dress rehearsal. I don't know if they had the ski masks on, but they rehearsed it so they could do it right. Now, you know, you may even be thinking, what was the point? Why did he need to involve these other two people? Why didn't he just make the whole thing up? Why didn't he just say, hey, you know, I got assaulted? Why did he actually have to act it out? After all, none of it was on video. What was the point of hiring actors? Because once you involve other people, you open yourself up because now you have other people who can contradict what you're saying, especially if they don't want to go to the jail themselves. You know, they're gonna rat you out. It would have been easier for him to have had no accomplices and just, you know, claim that he was the victim of an attack without actually having any people. Well, there's two reasons. One is the phone call to the manager. See, when he was concocting this crime, he tried to make it too perfect, which was one of the reasons that it was so suspicious. Well, one of the reasons that he wanted these two people is because he needed people to be yelling the racial slurs so that his manager could overhear those slurs and the MAGA country and all that, because his manager probably had no idea that this was being faked. And so he had to put on a show for the manager, which is why he was on the phone with his manager at 2:30 in the morning when he was attacked, which again makes no sense. Why would he be on the phone at 2:30 in the morning, right? That's a great time to call your manager. Hey, it's 2:30 in the morning. I'm walking out to get a sandwich. Let me call my manager. I mean, first of all, is the manager going to be awake? The manager could just, you know, what the hell? Hey, Jesse, hey, you know what time it is? Call me tomorrow. Although I read that he was out of the country. Maybe he was in Australia. So maybe Jesse knew that. And maybe there's, you know, a time difference. So maybe 2:30 in the morning, his time, you know, was an okay time to call. But why then? I mean, he's out. It's 20, 30 degrees below. I assume he's got gloves on. I mean, you have to take your gloves off to make a phone call. You got a sandwich and a salad in the other hand. I mean, you're cradling the phone. Why not wait until you get back to your warm apartment where you can take off your clothes and maybe while you're sitting down having your salad, make the phone call, right? And of course, the whole idea that, you know, he went out to get food at 2:30 in the morning. You know, initially I thought, why didn't he just call for room service, right? Because he was in a hotel. And then I realized that he wasn't in a hotel. He was at his own house, which makes it even more ridiculous. Doesn't he have a refrigerator? He had absolutely nothing in the refrigerator. Didn't have any, you know, any yogurt in there. Didn't have a frozen pizza that he could have toasted out of the, you know, in his freezer. He could have made a bowl of cereal or something. Did he have any crackers? I mean, he's got nothing. The house is empty. There's no food. I mean, I would eat almost anything rather than go out in that kind of weather at 2:30 in the morning, right? And hell, I mean, just go to sleep. I mean, I don't know if he was asleep. If he said, hey, I woke up and I was hungry, so I went to the restaurant. I mean, most people, you wake up and it's 2:30 in the morning. You just go back to sleep. That's what you do. You know, you wait till the morning and then you eat. But so none of this made any sense. But going back to his phone call, right, the reason that he was on the phone is because he wanted the manager to overhear the attack. And so he needed other people to be screaming, the N-word or, you know, calling him gay or fag or whatever they were doing. So he needed the people. But the other reason was he wanted it on film. This is what nobody is really picking up on. And I read about this, and I listened to an interview that he did, I guess, with ABC, where he talked about it. But when he initially reported the crime and the police showed up, he brought them down to the street where he said the assault took place. And then he pointed to a camera up on a light pole or something and said, look, here's a camera, right? The whole thing will be on tape. Get the tape. And I read that the police initially thought that was very suspicious that Smollett even knew that that camera was there, that it was kind of obscure and high up there. And how would have even noticed it? Well, I think what happened was he picked that spot because of that camera, right? He staged the fake assault under where he thought there was a camera. That's why he needed the actors, because it was going to be on film just so people can see that it actually happened and he didn't make it up, which is another reason why they were wearing the ski masks. So you couldn't see that the people attacking him were black and not white. And if you remember, when I first heard about this thing and still was very suspicious, but I didn't know to the degree that he staged the whole thing, I said, hey, wait a minute. He said they're wearing ski masks. How does he know they were white? Right, if you can't see the faces of the people who are attacking you, how do you know what color their skin is? Now, maybe he just assumed they were white because they were Trump supporters, although not all Trump supporters are white. Now, he can't assume they were white just because they were yelling out the N-word, because black people call other black people the N-word all the time. I mean, that's part of the culture. I mean, you would expect if you're black and you're attacked by other black men that they're going to call you the N-word. I mean, they call their friends the N-word, so they're certainly going to call their enemies, right, or whatever. So there was no proof that these people were white. So what he was going to do is, by having these guys with ski masks, right, attacking at night, they probably have gloves on, they're all bundled up, so you can't even see the color of their skin. But the whole thing was supposed to take place under a camera, right? Aha! Oh, lucky for Smollett, this attack that took place at 2:30 in the morning when there was nobody around to see it, it just so happens that the whole thing took place right under a camera. Only what Smollett did not know is that even though the camera looked like it was pointing in that direction, it was actually facing the opposite direction. And so none of the assault was actually caught on camera, which was opposite of what Smollett has actually planned. He orchestrated the whole thing. The Nigerian brothers rehearsed the fake assault, which they assumed was going to be caught on video as proof that it actually happened. And since there was no audio on the video, right, it was just video, he added the extra element of being on the phone with his manager so his manager could overhear the assault. And all that, again, is just too perfect. It's just too perfect that he had all that corroborating evidence of something that made absolutely no sense from the beginning would even take place. And in fact, now finally I'm reading that the police are beginning to realize what I said from day one, that Smollett sent that threatening letter to himself. That's the reason that he turned down the security protection. Because if you know there's no real threat, then you don't need security. If he actually was surprised to receive that letter because it came from a third party, he would have been scared. You know, it had a picture of him with a noose around his neck and a gun pointed to him and you're going to die and stuff like that. I mean, who would turn down free security unless you knew that there was nothing to be worried about because you sent the letter to yourself? And initially, from what I can tell, that was all he was planning to do. He was trying to get a lot of publicity just based on this letter. And when the letter didn't result in enough media coverage, then he came up with the idea of the fake attack. In fact, that is what the brothers told the police. That is how the whole thing evolved. It was, hey, he didn't get enough of reaction to the letter, and so he concocted this scam. Now, of course, after all this came out, Smollett is still denying it. In fact, he's claiming that he's a victim again. He's saying he's being victimized because people aren't believing his story. Well, they're believing the story of these other two men who are telling the truth. Now, are they the ones that are lying? Right? Why is Smollett telling the truth and they're lying? I mean, what they're saying makes a lot more sense. I mean, first of all, what was the motivation for these two Nigerian brothers to fake a hate crime against Smollett? I mean, what do they get out of it? Nothing. They didn't have anything to benefit. All they have is, well, the $3,500 that they got paid. But if they didn't get paid, right, according to Jesse Smollett, he had nothing to do with it. And these Nigerian brothers, right, they just decided on their own to put on ski masks, grab a noose, grab some bleach, and attack Jesse and pretend they didn't know him and pretend they were white. And they just assaulted him for what? The fun of it? I mean, they had nothing to gain. The only person that had something to gain was Smollett because he becomes a hero, right? I fought back, right? I fought the F back. I punched them in the face. I'm a tough guy, right? So he gets to be the tough man who fights off two attackers, and he now is, you know, a victim on a big scale. He's a hero of the left. It really makes his career. I mean, whether or not they were thinking of writing him off of Empire or not, who cares? Now he's a household name. Everybody knows who he is, right? So this was a publicity stunt with the benefit of also hurting Trump and helping to push a Democratic agenda, which he signs on to. He's a big Democrat and he supports Democratic candidates. And so this is a twofer. It allows him to damage the right, to damage Trump, to further the narrative of racism and, you know, and homophobia, and help his career. So he's the only one that has something to gain, right? So why should we believe him and not believe the two Nigerian brothers? I mean, they're black too, right? I mean, they're victims, although I guess Smollett is a double victim, right? He's black, but he's also gay. And I guess these Nigerian brothers are straight. So he out-victims them 2-1. So I guess if you're a double victim, then we have to believe you. And if you're only a single victim, well, then you're lying. But of course, this is all nonsense. That's why the police let these guys go. Their story made sense. Smollett's story doesn't make sense at all. In fact, the police want to talk to him again, and the lawyers, and he's all lawyered up now, of course, are advising him not to do it. They're taking this whole thing to a grand jury. And I'm sure that Smollett is going to get indicted for filing a false police report, which I think has up to 3 years jail time for Smollett. The thing that I'm still thinking about is that, did Smollett act alone, right? Or did Smollett have any help? Was there a conspiracy? Did other people know that this was going to happen, people in politics? Because a lot of it seems too coincidental to me. And, you know, first of all, before I even get to that topic, you see all these people on the left are so upset that this didn't happen. I mean, I'm actually seeing people complaining about the Trump supporters or conservatives who they say are rejoicing or celebrating the fact that the hate crime was a hoax. Well, the liberals are actually upset that the hate crime didn't take place. Think about that, right? They're finding out that this horrible crime that they described as horrific, right, where these people just grabbed this black man and beat him up and threw a rope on his neck in a mock lynching and poured bleach on him. They all described this as a horrible crime. They've now found out that it didn't happen. Rather than being relieved, right, that there's less racism and less hate and homophobia than they thought, they're upset. They're upset that it didn't happen. They wanted it to happen, right? Why is that? Because liberals want racism. They want homophobia. They want all this to happen. Look, just like they want poverty. I've talked about this for a long time, how the poverty pimps on the left, they want people to be poor. Why? Because if people are poor, then they'll vote for politicians promising them something for nothing. Hey, you're poor. The solution is me giving you this welfare or me giving you food stamps or all this. So if your voters are poor and you're selling these anti-poverty programs, you need poor people, right? The last thing the left wants is an end to poverty, because then they're out of business. Well, the same thing now with racism or homophobia or sexism, because it's not just poverty that the left is selling, it's victimhood. It's you're poor because you're a victim. It's not because you did anything wrong yourself. The deck is stacked against you. You've got these evil, you know, white men who are keeping you down because they're bigots, right? And they're racist and they're homophobes or whatever they are, right? And so in order to scare the victims into voting you, you need something to scare them. You need these hate crimes. And if they don't exist, then you have to manufacture them. So that is why the left is so upset that this hate crime didn't happen, because they want so much for it to happen. They want more hate crimes. The problem is there's not enough of them. right? There's a shortage. There's so much demand in the media. This is all they want to cover. They want ways to show how much hate there is and how much bigotry there is and how much race, you know, crimes there are. And since there's not enough, they make them up. But the minute they see one, the minute somebody says, hey, I'm a victim of this crime, oh, perfect. Let's run with the story. Let's not even bother to see if it even makes any sense. Let's not wait for the facts. Let's just go out there because this is what we want because it furthers our narrative. But the point I wanted to make on the politics of it is, you know, there's actually a bill that the Senate just passed, and I read it was unanimous, and I'm not 100% sure, but that's what I read. And this is the anti-lynching bill. And the Senate just passed it, I think, just right around Valentine's Day. I mean, after the Smollett incident happened. And so to me, it seems very coincidental that at the time Congress is voting on and passing an anti-lynching bill, that you have a fake crime that actually satisfies all of the conditions of this bogus anti-lynching bill. And the reason that I'm calling this anti-lynching bill bogus is because it has absolutely nothing to do with lynching, right? Here's the definition of lynching, right? I've looked it up on the internet. A lynching is an unlawful murder by an angry mob of people, right? Throughout history, dominant groups have used lynchings as a way of controlling minorities. So when you're talking about lynching of black people, you're talking about a white mob taking a black person, tying a rope around his neck, throwing the other end of the rope over a tree, and hanging that black person on that rope until he is dead, right? Murder, mass murder, right? Lynching is really bad, right? And for a long time, over 100 years, they've been trying to make lynching a federal crime, but they haven't been able to do it because it's already a crime. Murder is a crime, right? Murder is a state crime. The federal government should have no role in murder. I don't care if somebody is shot or lynched. Doesn't matter how they're murdered. If they're murdered, it is a state crime. The Constitution sets out three crimes for the federal government: piracy, counterfeiting, and treason. That's it. The rest of it is supposed to be handled by the states. And up until now, Congress, in its wisdom, refused to make murder a federal crime. Until now, until you have the Senate passing unanimously the first anti-lynching bill. Except it has nothing to do with lynching other than the title. I am reading from the anti-lynching bill now, Senate 3178. And if you skip through all the first part where it talks about how bad lynchings are over the years, and you just get to section 250, which is titled lynching, I'm going to read it word for word. It reads, one, offenses involving actual or perceived race, color, religion, or natural origin. So it's not even their actual race, but the perception of their race or religion, whatever. If two or more persons willfully cause bodily injury to any other person because of the actual or perceived race, color, religion, or national origin of any person, and then it goes on, you'll be in prison not more than 10 years or fined, blah, blah, blah. But that's it. So they have now defined lynching as causing bodily harm to another person. That's lynching? Lynching is causing bodily harm? I mean, it doesn't even say what type of bodily harm, any type. So if you punch somebody, you've now lynched them. Although if you read it again, it's two or more people. So in order for it to be a lynching, you have to have at least two people, which is coincidental about the alleged or the made up assault of Jesse Smollett. He was attacked by two people, and what those two people did qualifies under this act as lynching because they scratched his eye. There was some bodily harm. So, you know, according to this law, basically, you got two kids on a playground, you know, and they push another kid. If the kids who are white and they push a black kid down, he skins his knee, he's been lynched. I mean, come on. I mean, now, anytime you hurt somebody, you've murdered them, you have lynched them. I mean, this takes the cake, you know, when it comes to looking at rape, right? Where, you know, now you pat a girl's ass and somehow you've raped her or you sexually assaulted her. Well, now all you have to do is, you know, scrape somebody, push somebody down, and you've lynched them. Now, of course, they still had to work this thing into the Interstate Commerce Clause, right? Because that's how they're gaining jurisdiction on this, by trying to make it interstate commerce. So There is another section B, circumstances described. It says, for the purpose of subchapter A, the circumstances described in this subparagraph are that, one, the conduct described in subparagraph A, which is, you know, the bodily harm, occurs during the course of or as a result of travel of the defendant or the victim. So you had to travel, you know, I'm not really, you know, across the border. I'm not sure in what time period the travel had to take place, you know, within the assault, but it just it's broad on that. But then it says, or using a phone, the internet, the mail, or any other channel, facility, or instrument, or state of foreign commerce. So in other words, what made this assault or this alleged assault, if it actually would have happened, what made it a lynching, according to this act, was not just that two people committed bodily injury and they said it was because of skin color or sexual orientation, but because Smollett was on the phone. See, if either the defendant or the perpetrator is on the phone, then the fact that they were on the phone at the time of the assault means they were engaging in interstate commerce somehow, and therefore the government has jurisdiction to go after this made-up crime. Oh, and by the way, number two under the prime, it says, in general, if two or more persons in any circumstances described in subparagraph B willfully cause bodily injury to any other person because of the actual or perceived religion, national origin, gender, sexual orientation, gender identity, or disability of any person, right? So the other thing about the fake attack that was scripted by Smollett is not only did he fall under number one in that it was because of his skin color, it was also because of his sexual orientation. So it was a double lynching because he was lynched because he was black and he was lynched because he was a homosexual. Of course, he wasn't lynched at all. He was scraped. Maybe he was punched, but it is not a lynching. But we have now redefined the term lynching. And in fact, what this does really is it undermines the legitimacy. There are people who were actually lynched throughout history. There are actually people who were murdered, who were put to death by mobs. But you diminish that by saying that what is happening today is a lynching. In fact, why do we even have this bill? I mean, when was the last time somebody was lynched? I mean, 30 years, 40 years? I have no idea when the last time a mob of white people actually lynched a black person. There is no reason to have an anti-lynching bill. This is a bill for which there's no purpose. The only purpose is to pretend that there are lynchings. And that's why all the Republicans who voted for this are a bunch of cowards, because they're helping to perpetuate the false narrative that there are so many lynchings going on that the government needs to protect all these victims from lynchings, that white people are going out lynching black people all the time, and now we need a law. I mean, I know, I get it. I know why the Republicans voted for it, because no one wants to vote against the anti-lynching bill, right? Oh, you're in favor of lynching? Of course not. Nobody's in favor of lynching. This bill has nothing to do with lynching. Remember, I always talk about truth in legislating, which doesn't exist, right? The Patriot Act, the most unpatriotic act ever, has nothing to do with patriotism, but that's what it's called. This act has nothing to do with lynching. This is just throwing a bone to all the victims, right? Because what this law says is if you are a victim, right, if you're in the victim class, and if two or more people, you know, punch you or push you or scrape you, it's now a federal crime, right? So long as you can find a way to push it into the Interstate Commerce Clause because you use a cell phone or you travel, you did one of these things, or use the internet, right, which everybody does, right? So all of a sudden now this is a big federal crime. We have to, you know, federal prosecutors, 10 years in jail. I mean, this is absolutely ridiculous. And the fact that the Republicans have played into it because they're afraid to stand up and say, I'm going to vote against this bill because it's BS. Because it's not a federal crime to punch somebody. It's not a federal crime to scrape somebody or to push somebody. But this is what we're doing. And we're calling all of this conduct lynching, right? Just to bring up the memories of lynching and how horrible lynching was. And now we have this anti-lynching bill with lynching all over in the titles, yet the titles don't mean anything. It's the actual language of the law that counts, and there's nothing in here about lynching. If this bill actually said that it is a crime to lynch somebody, meaning hang somebody by the neck until they're dead, okay, right? Then it would be an anti-lynching bill. I would still be against it because lynching is already a crime under state law. But if they really wanted to make an anti-lynching bill, fine. I wouldn't vote for it, but it would be a complete waste of time because nobody is being lynched. But what they did is they basically made it a crime to do anything violent, to cause any kind of bodily injury to somebody, no matter how insignificant or minimal that bodily injury is, as long as it's at least two people who are involved, and the government could then claim that the two people acted based on race or sexual orientation or handicap or gender, any of this stuff, which of course, again, requires the government to be the thought police to try to pretend or that they know what motivated somebody to do something, right? I don't think it makes a difference. If two people attack another person and harm them in any way, I don't care if they did it because they didn't like the person's gender or the person's religion or the person's race, or they just didn't like him for some other, they didn't like the color of his clothes. They just didn't like the way he looked. They were just randomly assaulting people, and that was the unlucky guy, and they just attacked him, or it doesn't matter to me. You want to punish the act. You want to punish the crime itself. The only time that motivation is really important is when you talk about murder. Was it premeditated? Did somebody plan out in advance the murder? Or did they act in the heat of passion, right? So there's a difference between manslaughter and first-degree murder. And so there's some importance as to the motivation. But when you're just talking about two people at a bar and they get into a fight, and if the reason is because the guy doesn't like blacks and he gets in a fight with somebody because they're black, or he gets in a fight with somebody because they're homosexual, that doesn't make any difference versus he gets in a fight with them because he just doesn't like what he said, or maybe they were interested in the same girl, and it doesn't matter. It's the same crime, and it should have the same punishment, and they should all be state crimes. None of them should be federal crimes, but this is what we're doing, and all this is about making the federal government bigger, making the federal government more powerful. The more federal crimes there are, the more powerful the federal government is, the larger the federal government gets, the bigger the bureaucracy, and the less individual liberty. We diminish state rights. All these Republicans who voted for this nonsense, this Democratic fraud, because they don't have any backbone, what they're helping to do is expand government and diminish the rights of the states at the expense of the federal government. Now, obviously, it hasn't passed the House yet, but I'm sure it's going to pass the House. I mean, if it passed the Senate, the Republicans still control the Senate, and it passed the Senate. The question is, will Donald Trump sign this? This will be a real test if he actually is in a little bit, going to try to drain the swamp. Can he rise above the fray just a little bit to call this thing out? Everyone wants to talk about how gutsy he is and how he's willing to stand up. Let's see if he'll stand up against this. Let's see if he's willing to take the attacks that he's in favor of lynching, right, by vetoing a bill that has nothing to do with lynching, that is trying to use lynching, that is basically doing a disservice. You're basically stomping on the graves of every black person in history who was actually lynched. You are diminishing their suffering. You are diminishing their crime by trying to pretend that somebody getting punched, somebody getting pushed, and they just get minor injuries, that's the same thing as being murdered, being hung by your neck until you are dead. This is complete lunacy. This is where we are now as a nation. And somebody's got to stand up and say, I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore.